starring Frank Sinatra.
Who knows what evil lurks in the hearts of men?
And now, smile a while with Lorenzo Jones and his wife, Belle.
Here's the Manhattan merry-go-round that brings you the bright side of life, that whirls you in music to all the big night spots of New York town, to hear the top songs of the week sung so clearly you can understand every word and sing them yourself.
This is the Golden Age of Radio. I'm Dick Bertel, and tonight we'll take you on another audio excursion back to radio's formative years. You'll hear the programs that made the era golden and meet people who made those broadcasts a reality.
The Golden Age of Radio, brought to you by Burritt Mutual Savings Bank, serving Central Connecticut since 1889, and by WTIC. You'll meet radio producer Hyman Brown after these words from the Burritt.
This message about saving money is brought to you by the Big B, Burritt Mutual Savings Bank, the money place. You've heard about the new higher rates on savings accounts. Maybe you've seen ads that mention 7% or more interest on savings certificates. Well, a savings certificate is a special account. 2.5 years is the minimum term on the new 6.75% certificates. At the Big B, Burritt Mutual, they work like this. Deposit $1,000 in one of these certificates and leave it on deposit, and you'll earn even more than 6.75%. That's because Burritt pays you interest continuously, and the interest earns interest too. So the actual yield at maturity comes to 7.08% at the Big B. That's the straight story, the facts. That's what you'll get at any office of the Big B in New Britain, West Hartford, Glastonbury, Wethersfield and Rocky Hill, and now in Newington. Member FDIC.
And now for the Golden Age of Radio, Dick Bertel.
Good evening. Our program is coming to you from New York tonight. We're in the offices of one of the biggest producers of radio of the past and soon to be radio of the future. Ed Corcoran, our guest, is a giant in our industry.
Yes, Dick, one of the most innovative producers of all time, and he gave us such shows as Inner Sanctum Mysteries, Grand Central Station, The Thin Man, Nero Wolf, and you could go on the rest of the half hour just giving all these shows, Dick, but here he is. Dick, shake hands with Hyman Brown.
Hyman Brown, it's a pleasure to meet you and to welcome you to the Golden Age of Radio.
I'm happy to be a part of it and enjoy meeting both of you and talking about the most wonderful time of my life, the years I spent producing, creating, and directing radio drama.
You know, I think perhaps this can be the most exciting interview we've conducted on the program because it's going to enable us to look ahead for the first time. We've been on the air for over 3 years, and we've had to talk about the 30s and the 40s and the early 50s when radio disappeared from the scene. But now, radio, thanks to you and CBS, is coming back.
And it's coming back in such form, with such virility, with such excitement, that I myself am almost overwhelmed by what it portends for the future. We broke the mold, literally. That's the only way to bring something back. We're going to be on the air 7 nights a week with a 53-minute complete mystery drama each night. 7 nights a week. Never in the history of radio broadcasting did anybody attempt to do a series 7 nights a week.
How did it all happen? Whose idea was it?
The idea was one of many that I had in my heart and in my gut for the last 5, 6, 8 years, and I've been trying with networks and with agencies to make them realize that radio drama is one of the most unique forms of entertainment in the world of theater, in the world of communication, and they somehow didn't respond to me. You must know from all that happens on your program and the responses you get mm-hmm. that radio drama offers a listener something which they could not conceivably get in theater, in motion pictures, or in television. Your imagination, you, yourself, your fantasy, comes to the spoken word, and you create a unique form of identification, a unique relationship to what's happening, and it enhances. I call it color radio. You can do anything you want with your imagination once I lead you to the point of exercising that imagination.
I follow that. I follow your reasoning there. But, of course, there were tremendous hurdles to be overcome. Affiliates were no longer really interested in carrying lengthy network programs.
They were almost overwhelming, as you can imagine. The need to bring back radio drama was in me. On their part, radio had become music and news and a service rather than an entertainment. And how to make them understand that word entertainment was the crux of all my attempts. Fortunately, very fortunately, Sam Diggs, who is the president of CBS Radio, and I, we were old friends, and we would kick this around at lunch once or twice every 6 or 8 months. And then about a year or a year and a half ago, when I came to him with this idea of 7 nights a week to create a habit once again, so that the station that carries the drama can truly say, we're the drama station. You can't become stations, as you know today, radio stations, are programs.
That's
a station
right.
plays a particular kind of thing. It's either all news or all rock or all music of the 40s or all music of the... Here we are back with something where the station can say, we are the drama station. You got to give them a reason for this.
When was the decision made by CBS to go ahead?
I was invited to come down to Serramar Beach to address the CBS affiliate board. Now, this is a group of 15 station owners, managers, who represent the 260 network stations. They make the decisions. They try to think for the others, and usually they set the pattern. I came in, they didn't expect me, and I spoke to these 15 hard, tough, cynical men who have to make a dollar and have to run a station that's number one in their market. And every single one of them, for the first time in the history of the affiliate board, said, we'll carry it. Well, with that as a stimulus, we then decided we would go out and try it on other people. We went to KMOX, we went to WCCO, and New York City, CBS is all news. We went to WOR. Everybody said, we'll carry this. We then went to the advertising people and tried to make them understand that there is an audience out there. The numbers don't show it. And they responded.
Well, why did you decide to come up with new shows rather than to reissue some of the old ones, which were so popular, huh?
First off, there's a lot of the old stuff, as you put it, kicking around. There are several of my competitors who have been selling The Shadow and The Lone Ranger and Green Hornet and so on. To me, those shows never represented an important form of drama. You know, I look at radio drama as an art form. That may sound kind of highfalutin, but it is an art form. There's a special technique that's needed by actors and by writers and by producers and directors to create this ambiance which says radio drama. And at its best, The Green Hornet, let's say, and The Shadow were just, you know, shows. I didn't want to go back. I wanted to go forward. I felt that the dialogue patterns of 74, that the recording techniques of 74, that the whole style of relationship between actor and spoken word is different in 74. And it is.
Of course it is. I want to get back to this new concept in radio later in our program, but hi, I want to put all of it into perspective now. I want our audience, and we have many, many young people who listen to us each month, I want them to know who Hyman Brown is. Not who he was, but who he is. So I think perhaps we should go back to the very beginnings. I'd like to talk about WBZ, WBZA for a start.
Oh, my word, yes. That goes back to 1933. I came to Boston to test Dick Tracy. There was a sponsor in those days who had a program called the Tasty East Jesters. And I came along and said, if you want to reach a younger market, why don't we do Dick Tracy? I'd gotten the rights from the Chicago Tribune Daily News Syndicate. And they thought it might be a good idea, but you just don't go on full blown. We'll test it on WBZ and WBZA Springfield. And so I went to Boston in 1933, and we went on 3 nights a week. And that's where the signature, calling all cars, I created that. And there was a siren. And we couldn't find an electric siren in 1933 in Boston. So I got one from the fire department, but it had a handle. and you cranked it up and you could never stop it. So those were the early days, yes. Dick Tracy worked in Boston for about 6 months, and we went network about 1936.
And now, Dick Tracy.
Let's go, men. Yes, it's Dick Tracy, protector of law and order. And now, Dick Tracy.
In yesterday's story, you saw how the evidence began to pile up, making Tracy sure that Spike Connolly was responsible for the dynamiting of the empty safe. You remember, too, how Sergeant Martin, while distributing posters of the description of Spike and his girlfriend, reported to Tracy his suspicions concerning the occupants of a certain house. Jumping into their car, Dick and Pat were soon there. While Dick rang the front doorbell, Pat went around to the rear to forestall any escape from that direction. Inside, Spike and Gert didn't know of Pat's whereabouts, made their way slowly toward the rear of the house. Today, Spike and Gert are almost at the back door. Dick is still ringing the front doorbell. Listen.
Just follow me, Gert. We'll get out this back door and beat it.
But they've probably got cops all around the block. We're never going to get away with this, Spike.
Shut up and come on. They put a back door.
Listen. They're surrounding the block.
Never mind that. Once you're around here, we can get the car out of the garage and give them a slip. Now, take it easy. I'm going to open the door. It's okay. Come on.
All right, not so fast, you two. Stand right where you are.
Harry's got...
Never mind that, sister. Just stay right where you are.
Now, look, mister, we ain't done nothing. We were just going
Save out. That, save that. I know who you both are. Now, stick out your hands.
Oh, yes, sir. Oh, so you want to play that way, eh? Well, here goes me, but don't... Hit him, Gert. Not this time. No.
How do you like that, eh?
Oh.
Girl.
Come on, Spike. I knocked him out. I hit him with my shoe. Let's go.
Yeah. Head for the garage. I saw a car in there.
The door wasn't locked.
Quick. Now, this thing will only start.
Spike, we can't go on the Broadway. The cops.
Hang on.
Gee, Spike, we made it.
That's right, kid. I had to drive through the back of the garage or else go out the front.
So they're after us.
Look out the back. Can you see them?
No, I can't see them. But that siren sounds closer.
I'm gonna take this next corner. Now, take another look.
We're okay. We're in the clear. I don't even hear the siren anymore.
Did I tell you, kid? I said we'd make it, didn't I?
We wouldn't have made it unless I hit that guy in the head with my shoe.
Ah, you're great, baby. You're nice and cold.
Yeah. Well, where are we going? Spike.
Well, I ain't decided yet. Gotta put a couple of miles between us and the cops. Too busy driving right now to think of anything else.
What are you stopping for, Spike?
I ain't stopping. Something's the matter with this car.
What? We're out of gas.
Shut up.
Oh. That's what it is. It didn't have any gas in it.
I'd better get out and take a look.
Don't miss tomorrow's exciting chapter in the adventures of Dick Tracy. This is the Blue Network of the American Broadcasting Company.
What was your background, Hi?
I'm a lawyer. It all began much before 1933 because in 1929, I was on the air Saturday mornings as part of a kind of almost high school college stunt so that I could write something for the school paper. I was doing Jewish dialect things on NBC in the morning. I'd been on 2 weeks when I got a phone call from up in the Bronx, and a woman on the phone says, my name is Gertrude Berg, and I got a series called The Rise of Molly Goldberg. Could you come and meet with me? She said, I like the way you do Jewish dialect. I've got a story about a Jewish woman. You could be the salesman and the play the part of Jake, maybe. The old man. I was all of some teenage. At any rate, she would be Molly and write the scripts. And sure enough, I sold it in 1929 to NBC, to Phillips Carlin. And that was the beginning. I went on and did many, 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 many shows, happily, creatively, and with great joy. But I quickly realized that if I'm to direct and produce and create, there were plenty of actors who were better than I was. And I left the acting thing, although I joined AFTRA when AFTRA was created, and I still am ham enough to hope that I can play a part somewheres, but I do all my talking straightforward as a salesman and as a personality rather than as an actor.
We'll get back to our guest, Hyman Brown, right after this.
This message about saving money is brought to you by the Big B, Burritt Mutual Savings Bank, the money place. Confused by all the ads about new higher interest rates on savings accounts? Many people are. Some banks are advertising 5% as a top rate. Some are even advertising rates over 7% on special types of accounts. Well, these are the facts. Federal regulations control the amounts that financial institutions can pay you. And only thrift institutions like Burritt Mutual Savings Bank can pay you the maximum amounts controlled by law. For example, 5.25% is the new legal rate allowed on regular accounts at savings banks. That's the top rate allowed. No one can pay you more. Some banks can't pay you as much. To get all the facts, get to the Big B, Burritt Mutual Savings Bank, in New Britain, West Hartford, Glastonbury, Wethersfield and Rocky Hill, and now in Newington. Burritt Mutual Savings, the money place. Member FDIC.
You're listening to the Golden Age of Radio with Dick Bertel and the recordings of Ed Corcoran. Brought to you by Burritt Mutual Savings Bank, serving Central Connecticut since 1889, and by WTIC.
Our guest tonight is Hyman Brown, producer of the new CBS mystery series, which takes to the air on January the 6th. And really, that is the thrust of our conversation. And hi, I promise we'll get back to it. But Ed, what were some of the shows that High has been very closely associated with?
Well, of course, they're all very well remembered, Inner Sanctum, Grand Central, and Nero Wolfe. And I wonder, High, if you could tell us, you know, where you got some of the thoughts or how these originated, some of these shows.
Well, sure, it's not hard. The many, many of these things came out of comic strips and came out of rights and books, like I did David Harum, I did Way Down East. Many of them you just boldly go out and create. When I was doing Dick Tracy, for instance, we had a door that you simply couldn't use except once in a blue Sunday because it creaked. The door was just a bad door, we considered it. It creaked, and oh, whenever we found it in the control room or in the studio, I'd hit the ceiling. And then suddenly it dawned on me, maybe there's some very, very good things about something that's very, very bad. And that creak impressed itself on me, and I said, would you believe it, fellas? That creak's gonna be the star of a show. And that's how the creaking door happened. And when I sold it to Carter's Little Liver Pills, I had been doing Grand Central Station, and that was for Lambert Pharmaceutical. And the man who owned Carter's was very close to the Lambert Pharmaceutical people because they were both drug houses. And he called me one morning and he said, I play golf with whoever runs and owns Listerine, and I would like a show like that. What have you got? So I came down with the creaking door, and I came down with Bulldog Drummond, and I came down with, I figured the first night of works, I would do dress rehearsal, because after all, we'd be there the night before the show opened. So he listened to all three shows, and he said, I like that mystery series, but I don't like the title, The Creaking Door. I said, what's wrong with The Creaking Door? I don't know. He said, did you have any other titles? Well, with a kind of tongue-in-cheek, I had no other title at that moment. They were down on Park Row, way, way downtown, and I'd gone down on the subway that morning. And in back of the New Yorker magazine, there was always a one-column ad for a group of detective stories published by Simon & Schuster called Inner Sanctum Detective Stories. So I said, how about Inner Sanctum? He said, that might be better. I didn't know what the relationship. Then I first had to go to Simon & Schuster and make some kind of an arrangement with them to use the two or three words that belonged to them. But the creak was mine. I had created that. There are only two sounds in the United States that carry a trademark, not only a copyright. The NBC chimes, which you use,
sure,
and the creaking door. They're both trademarked.
For goodness
sake. That's how the creaking door happened. Nero Wolfe happened because I was sitting on the writer's war board with Rex Stout. He's a neighbor. He lives in Danbury. A glorious man, incidentally. But I got a call from William Shaving Cream. Would I be able to do a detective series for them? And sure, I said, I'd like to do Nero Wolfe. But what's interesting about Nero Wolfe is this is a fat man. And how do you put a fat man on radio where you don't see him as a fat man? What kind of a signature would you create for a fat man? What is the sound that is most fat, most representational of a fat man? Nero Wolfe.
Well, stepping on a scale, but it's not the answer you
no,
want.
No, they did that. They did that. They did a series called The Fat Man to counteract my thin man, and the guy got on the scale, and you're like, no, that's too obvious. That's corny.
Oh, how about his breathing?
That, you're much, much closer to home, because what I took was the laugh. There is nothing like the laugh of a fat man, because all that blubber, if you permit me, begins to roll. And the first sound you heard was this... this wheeze of a fat man, as you indicated, and then the which I can't imitate, but you just rolled, and you knew a fat man was going to be there. Now, if I had to do Nero Wolfe as a television show, I'd be hard put to create a Nero Wolfe in the image that you want him created in.
It's the detective genius who rates the knife and fork the greatest tools ever invented by man. The ponderous, brilliant, and unpredictable Nero Wolfe, created by Rex Stout and brought to you in the person of Mr. Sidney Greenstreet.
Joe, I didn't believe the letters I got. Didn't believe them until now. I've been a lonely man. No wife, children. Joe, it was all coming to you after I died. There was no need for you to steal from me. All you had to do was wait. Joe, that gun. Put it down.
No. No.
Archie.
Yes, Mr. Wolfe.
How much longer?
Oh, an hour, maybe.
What on earth is that?
Sounds like a river.
Indeed.
Except there aren't any rivers around here.
Hey.
Yeah?
Up ahead.
What?
It's a river. Only it isn't a river.
It's wet.
It's wet and it's got waves on it. Had to start raining, too.
Nature. Free.
The road behind us is covered with water. We just have to keep going onward and upward.
An inferno engine has died.
No. The road dips up ahead. And where it dips, there's a junior Mississippi growing up.
Splendid.
Not so splendid. We can't go back and we can't go forward.
Why not?
They didn't build this model to swim.
No foresight. What do we do now?
Well, we could abandon the car and...
Walk, are you mad? Are you seriously suggesting I end out in a foot race with the flood?
Yeah, well, not seriously, but...
You've decided to give the car a swimming lesson?
No. There's what looks like a cow path leading off the highway. To your right. Maybe it's a road.
We progress. We now follow the footstep of the cow.
Ah, it is a road. An old dirt road. Not only that, it goes up.
Is that good?
Theoretically. We might get above the water that way.
And if the theory fails?
Mr. Wolfe, how are you on the Australian crawl? Hey, there's been another car on this road before us. You can see the tire tracks in the mud.
Interesting. An indication that there are other maniacs about. I myself would not have chosen this particular spot to picnic in.
That's not that. There's somebody lying on the road. Hold on a moment. Mr. Wolfe, you better come out here.
Serious, Archie?
Very serious.
Oh, very well.
Still alive, but...
The man's been shot. He's mumbling.
Joe.
Be still.
Don't forgive stealing. Don't...
So much for that. Pay him about you. Put him in the car.
Might be bad for him to be moved.
No. There is nothing that can be bad for him. He's dead. Is this blasted road leading anywhere, Archie?
Well, seems to be a clearing up ahead. Maybe. Hey, it's a house.
Splendid.
I'm not so sure. First up on top of a cliff, surrounded on three sides by nothing. On the side facing us is a deep ravine and a small wooden bridge.
An island in the air.
Yeah. High enough to keep above water, maybe, but... Now, that bridge doesn't look too good. Rain may have weakened it.
There's no choice, Archie. I have no intention of being drowned in these barbaric surroundings. The bridge, Archie.
Okay, hold on. Ooh, that thing's collapsing under us.
How momentum, sir?
Well, if it doesn't, 37 blondes are going to be wearing black. Correction, 38. I forgot the one in Gimble's bargain basement. Hey, we made it. The bridge will never be the same, though. There's a car ahead of us in front of the house.
The car from which our friend, our dead friend, was thrown. Only one set of car tracks in the mud along the road and here.
And all we have to do is walk in, ask for the owner of the house, and...
Possibly, and possibly not. Archie, go through the corpse's pockets.
Driver's license. The name was James Miller. Address Garner Lane. Walden. Now, I've got an idea this is Garner Lane, Mr. Wolf.
In which case, someone named Joe was looking after the house for him, committed theft, and murdered Miller. Miller's body was then dumped on the road in the hopes that the flood would wash the body away. No one at the house seems to have noticed their arrival.
Nope. Well, let's go in and ask for Joe, huh?
Very well. Odd. With the bridge down, there's absolutely no way of getting on or off this bridge.
Nobody's going to break a leg rushing to open the door.
I suppose you try.
Hey, somebody was careless leaving the door open like that. On the other hand, has a spider ever shut its web? The answer is no. Are we flies? Yes.
Out of my way, Archie.
Hi, during the height of your career, during those... golden days of radio, if you will. How many shows were you doing a week?
I did as many as 4 and 5 shows a day. Oh. I did Terry and the Pirates and Dick Tracy back to back. And early in the day, I would do David Harum. And then I would do a half hour of Grand Central Station and so on. I would say that somewhere between 35 and 40,000 broadcasts passed through my hands. That's consider.
Incredible amount.
Joyce Jordan was on the air for 18 years. That's 5 times a week. Times 52, that's 260 shows times 18 years. So you've got way over 2,000 shows right there from one series alone.
Hi, we've talked to many radio actors during the course of this program, and we always get down to the basic fact that there was a nucleus from which all radio producers chose. Very, very seldom would there be someone from the outside brought in other than a motion picture actor, someone who had prominence. Why?
We all worked with what, not only a nucleus, but a kind of a stock company. But that stock company was flexible. When Dick Widmark had to leave, or when Frank Lovejoy went off, others had to take their place. You have to work with a group. But my group was maybe 100, 150 actors. Mandel Kramer, Mason Adams, Ralph Bell, Leon Janney, Alex Scorby. It goes on and on and on. Larry Haynes, Mercedes McCambridge, Elspeth Eric. These are the best people in the business. Some of them have gone on to very, very important places in theater and in motion pictures. Many of them will be back with me on my series. I've heard from Dick Widmark, from Agnes Moorehead, from Jack Gilford, from Zero Mostel, from Kim Hunter. They'll all be doing shows for me.
Let's look ahead now. Let's talk about the present. The name of the show is...
The CBS Radio Mystery Theater.
All right, so basically we can count on mysteries seven
yes.
nights a week.
Mystery is a flexible word. It's the macabre, the suspense, the eerie, the unexplained, the unseen, we'll do ESP kind of things, the occult stuff that deals with outer space, maybe some science fiction, but no detective stories. I don't want to get into, have to bog down into explanations and detective mysteries. I don't care if I don't explain to you the phenomena that we're dealing with. They're just tight, good mystery suspense stories.
High radio drama has been dormant for 20 years, for a full generation. Now, in that period of time, what changes have taken place as far as radio drama that, as you conceive of it, is concerned?
Well, first off, the whole production technique has changed. I'll be recording on equipment that didn't exist 20 years ago. I have a 16-channel console. I'll only use one or two channels, but I have 16 channels. The whole world of sound has changed. We can now put sound into cartridges. You don't have to spot a record. The cartridge hits the sound right on the button, the gunshot. We can make continuous loops now of street noises, of crowds, of backgrounds of all kinds, so that sound is better. All my music will be on cartridges, so I have no needle scratches, I have no surface noises to contend with. And then, of course, the whole world of tape recording changes. My actor, if he flubs a line, we stop, go back four speeches, and I edit it out afterwards. I don't like the quality of the, let's say, the railroad background. I add some more sounds to it when I re-record afterward. Then, even acting styles, the intensity of acting, the relationship of my actors one to the other, and the relationship of them to me as a director, that's changed in the last 20 years. The relationships of people in general has changed. Basically, we remain the same. I Love You is still as potent as it was 10,000 years ago.
What about the studio? When I made arrangements to interview you through Dick Brescia of CBS, he told me that they are outfitting a completely new studio for
yes,
you.
That's absolutely true. We're taking one of the large studios that is on 52nd Street that used to be part of the CBS radio setup, and we're changing it around, putting in these sound effect consoles and cartridge machines that I've spoken of, and the whole setup will be for me for 1974. Nobody else will use the studio. How could they? I've got to be in there to make seven shows a week.
How about the writers? Are you going to go back to the old stable, or are you going to develop new writers for this concept, Hi?
Two things are going to happen. I definitely want to develop new writers. It's very, very important and very necessary. Right from your area, the O'Neill Workshop, George White, who is the president of the O'Neill Workshop, has been in to see me. We've spoken. He has some 400 or 500 people there. I hope to set up a seminar on radio writing when they hold the workshop next May. He has given me a list of people who might be interested, and we will try to work with them. To get off the ground, I have fortunately been able to fall back on a group of wonderful, wonderful writers who are trained and experienced and have all been doing television and novels and movies and everything under the sun and theater, but are so happy for the opportunity to come back to radio writing. I have George Lothar, I have Henry Slezar, I have Sam Dan, Sidney Sloan, who for years wrote The Shadow, Murray Burnett, who for years did True Detective, and Marlene Dietrich. These are some of the people whom I've been able to revive in a sense with very little effort, to come back and write. I already have mimeographed, you can see if you look, 20 scripts. Now, in the old days, that used to be almost a half year's work. Mm-hmm. It's 3 weeks worth of work now. It's a different world, and this is what I mean by Radio 74 as against what it was.
What are the limitations placed upon a writer writing for radio?
Nothing. He has absolutely none of the inhibitions that a television or motion picture writer has. Today, to write for television, you're constantly beset by production costs, how many sets, how many setups. You know, you can't go beyond a certain area. I can take you and put you in outer space. I can put you at the bottom of the ocean. I can put you at the North Pole, in the deserts of Africa, all by saying what it is. And you come to me with your own idea. Sound is so valuable. Consider I use this as an example, and it's a very wonderful, happy one. The world of medicine, Dr. Welby, I never was without a medical show. I did Hilda Hope, M.D., and Joyce Jordan, M.D., and Dr. Friendly, and Knickerbocker Hospital and City Hospital, all these shows, they go on and on. But if I wanted to do an operating room, I didn't have to do what they do in the movies. My God, they have a huge set. Every big company has a standard operating room because they do so many medical shows. And 42 extras and nurses and people and guys. All I did was put one actor on the microphone and he breathed, you know? We knew we were in an operating room because our voices dropped. And then the sound effect man put on a little oscillator, which was monitoring the heart, and went beep, beep, and then actually a heartbeat, bloom, bloom. You know, we put the stethoscope, the microphone against a guy's heart instead of the stethoscope, and you got the true heartbeat. That was the height of everything, when the microphone reproduced the true heartbeat. At that point, I could go into any operation, from a hematoma of the brain to a resection of the anything. You created the atmosphere that no physical setup could give me. So my writers have no inhibitions.
Now, inasmuch as the program will probably be taped by a number of affiliates and played back at different hours and perhaps even during the daytime, does this cause any problem for you?
No, the program actually will never be played back in the daytime because we've
put... Is that one of the restrictions?
Yes, that's been restricted. But somewhere is between 7 and 11 at night, because yes, you will find on Saturday and Sunday, patterns will change for listening. Many stations have ball games and sporting events which come at different times, so we'll either go on before or after. But the habit to know that every single night, every single day of the year at night, you can listen to a complete drama, is something which should excite almost everybody in America. I think there is something so special between the listener and the other side of the microphone in the studio. Very special. I don't feel I'm talking to two men now. I feel I'm talking to a whole world, all of the people that you have created for me because of what you're doing.
Hi, we usually ask our guests, and I'm going to ask you, if you had one show that you'd like to hear again from Ed's collection, something that you did, what would it be?
That's going to be very, very difficult to answer, because it's like saying, which of five children do you like best, or do you like your mother better than your father, or do you like... you simply can't say that. I would say that the Inner Sanctum Mysteries, the Creaking Door series, gave me the greatest excitement, the series as a whole, because I had an incredible relationship with an audience who really lived and moved through these weird, fantastic stories of suspense and mystery. That gave me a great excitement. And I enjoyed doing them. It was fun to come in every week. And I remember I used to have Boris Karloff and Peter Lorre and Claude Rains, along with Dick Widmark and Mercedes McCambridge. And it was a wonderful, wonderful excitement.
Inner Sanctum Mysteries. Good evening, friends of the Creaking Door. This is your host to welcome you again into the Inner Sanctum. Come in. Come on in. No, no, please don't stand on ceremony. We're all informal here. No ties, no collars. In some cases, no heads. Well, that doesn't mean we're complete boors, though. We study our Emily ghost faithfully. You wouldn't catch one of us eating his peas with a knife. Oh, no. We've been caught with knives before. Sowing, you might say, our wild throats. Well, the preliminaries are over, beginning right now. Things are going to happen. So sit up, draw a deep breath, and lend us an ear.
We've got to get our teeth into something. Listen now to the voice of Donald Bucher as Danny Williams, as he tells the weird story of the dead walk at night.
There it is again.
Danny.
My uncle. Calling to me. Just as he used to when I was a boy.
Where are you, Danny?
My blind uncle tapping his cane and calling.
Danny, where are you?
He's dead. I wish I could join him.
Danny.
I've tried to 1,000 times, but they've always prevented me.
Danny.
Tapper. 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 It goes on incessantly. It never stops. Even when I sleep, I hear it every minute, every second. Sometimes soft, crashing thunder.
Danny! Danny!
Can't you stop it? Can't you give me 1 minute's peace?
Danny!
Why don't you stop it, you blind old fool?
Danny!
Leave me alone! Haven't you done enough? Leave me alone! Tapped that way with his cane. On the night I decided to kill him. We were in his room in the big house where we lived together. I had been living with him since I was 14 years old. For 10 years I'd been his companion, his nurse, his servant, his slave. On the night I was going to kill him, I slipped a length of strong cord into my dinner jacket. He was totally blind. Had been for 30 years. Yet, strangely enough, he could see. He could see with his uncanny, highly developed sense of hearing. And with that cane of his, that cane that was everlastingly tapping.
The wind's blowing up tonight. It'll be getting cold soon.
Yes.
Dan, all the servants gone?
This is their night off.
You going out again tonight?
Yes.
With Martha?
Yes, with Martha.
Hmm. Will you pour me some brandy?
Yes, Morgan. I poured out the drink. In my pocket, I felt the cord, and as I handed the drink to him, I took it out and walked behind him. Now, this was the time. Slip the cord around his neck. Twist it. It would be over soon. He sat there, holding the glass in one hand.
Very good brandy, this.
I raised the cord over his head. All I had to do was drop it over his neck.
Why are you standing behind me?
Well, how did you know?
I heard you walk there. Why, Danny?
I just wanted to look out of the window. One quick move, it would be over. But I didn't want to kill him, so I suddenly missed. I'd make a clean breast of it and give him a chance.
Well, Dan, how long are you going to stand there?
Morgan, there's something I want to speak to you about.
Well, what is it, my boy?
I want to marry Martha.
I thought that was on your mind.
But I need $10,000, Morgan. Will you give it to me? What are you laughing at?
You. I was just waiting to see how much you'd ask for. You lied your way in pretty deeply this time, didn't you, Danny?
What are you talking about?
We had a very interesting little talk.
Did you?
Hmm. You told her you're wealthy. Why?
Did you tell her the truth?
No. You always were an incorrigible liar.
But Morgan, she got the impression that I had some money because I lived in this house.
And now you have to live up to that impression so you can marry her.
But you'll give me the money, won't you?
Why'd you lie to her?
I did it without thinking. I wanted to tell her the truth, but I couldn't. I was afraid that if she found out that I'd lied, she'd hate me. Morgan, are you going to give me the money?
Danny, I'm very fond of you. I took you in to live with me when you were a poor, penniless gutter snipe. I educated and taught you to live like a gentleman. I even named you sole beneficiary of my estate.
But that's why I'm asking you for the money now. If you're going to leave me all of it, why don't you give me a little of it now?
Because I don't want you to marry Martha.
Why not?
I don't think she's the girl for you.
You stupid, blind old fool.
Anne.
Martha's the finest girl I ever met. I won't have you talking about her like this.
You won't have a penny of my money to marry her.
You're doing this because you want me to stay with you.
Now, what are you talking about?
From the very first day I came here, it's been Danny do this, Danny do that. Danny, read to me. Danny, pour me some brandy. You've made me a servant and a slave.
How can you talk this way after all I've done for you?
Done for me? Did you ever teach me to work? Did you ever teach me to do anything except live in luxury when I didn't have a penny to my name? You made me someone who's of no earthly good to anything or anyone except you.
Well, what are you going to do about it? Leave?
No. I'm not going to leave, Morgan. You are.
What do you mean?
I'm going to kill you.
Danny, if you think you can frighten me into giving you that money, you're quite mistaken.
I don't intend to frighten you. I intend to murder you.
Yeah. You're not serious.
Yes, I am, Morgan.
Danny, you got up, I heard you.
Yes.
Now, don't lose your head. Perhaps we can come to some agreement.
It's too late for that. Don't think you can stall me and then turn me over to the police.
Danny, where are you?
You'll know in a minute, Morgan. When you feel something on your neck.
Oh! Oh. I can only...
I'm going to be merciful, Morgan. It'll only take a few seconds, and this cord will crush the life out of you. Morgan? Morgan? He's dead.
Well, friends, do you think Uncle Morgan will stay dead? Oh, you do, hmm? Well, that shows how much you know. On this program, the dead never stay that way. You're going to find corpses that walk in the dead of the night.
Oh, yes.
They do, all right. They do. Don't you worry.
This message about saving money is brought to you by the Big B, Burritt Mutual Savings Bank. The money place. You've heard about the new higher rates on savings accounts. Maybe you've seen ads that mention 7% or more interest on savings certificates. Well, a savings certificate is a special account. 2.5 years is the minimum term on the new 6.75% certificates. At the Big B, Burritt Mutual, they work like this. Deposit $1,000 in one of these certificates and leave it on deposit, and you'll earn even more than 6.75%. That's because Burritt pays you interest continuously, and the interest earns interest too. So the actual yield at maturity comes to 7.08% at the Big B. That's the straight story, the facts. That's what you'll get at any office of the Big B in New Britain, West Hartford, Glastonbury, Wethersfield and Rocky Hill, and now in Newington. Member FDIC.
Hi, Brown. It's been great fun getting together with you, and so refreshing on this program to be able to look ahead for the first time. That's a real breakthrough.
Well, my plans with CBS go far beyond the one strip, because if the mystery strip is going to take on, as it will, and I know it will, we're going to do a Playhouse strip, 7 nights again, back to back. We will do stories of human interest, of family, of a father and son, of mother and daughter, of husband and wife. We'll do adventure, we'll do westerns perhaps, and some detective stuff. That would be the Playhouse, the kind of thing that we're so familiar with. Then I have a prestigious sponsor who said, would you like the Metropolitan Opera, which goes on Sunday, Saturday afternoons, do a once a week 2-hour special from the classics of America? Sherwood Anderson, O'Neill, Saroyan, Arthur Miller, Maxwell Anderson, and that's in the works. And what also is in the works, a man called Steve Frankfurt, who's really a brilliant man. He was president of Young Rubicam and a great radio buff, called and said, how about some children's programs? And I said, of course. And you can make him happen because of his particular relationship at the moment. And he said, all I want to know is, are you available? I'll make him happen. Children's programs. Can you imagine coming back with some beautiful, beautiful things for children? And finally, if we could ever clear the time in the daytime, you mentioned daytime, it's almost impossible to clear time, I want to come back with 2 hours of soaps. 4 half-hour shows back to back. No more 15 minutes, mm-hmm. because I don't believe in 15 minutes as being able to express anything. But 4 half-hours back to back. Again, it's a block, it's a habit, and we would come back with such an impact because I don't believe the women look at television. They listen to television. And we would give them something they could listen to with soaps, with daytime radio again.
Hi, if you're successful, I think you'll be putting us out of business.
That's right. No more nostalgia. It's here today. But that's right. It's just great.
You'll do the radio of the 70s, and you'll interview all the wonderful new people and all the people that are working at it with me. You'll have a wealth of material that'll be vital.
We've been talking about this for so long, Dick. I just wanted to say that, you know, we've been dreaming about this happening because that's why we started the show, to get people interested. And this is really the end right here. You've got everything that we ever hoped would ever come back.
I hope all your listeners and all your friends will tune us in and let you know what they think of my 1974 efforts.
Hi, Brown. Thank you so much for visiting with us on the Golden Age of Radio. And now until next time, this is Dick Bertel.
This is Ed Happy Corcoran.
Good night.
The Golden Age of Radio with Dick Bertel and the recordings of Ed Corcoran has been brought to you by Burritt Mutual Savings Bank, serving Central Connecticut since 1889. Be sure to hear the next Golden Age of Radio broadcast January 23rd, when you'll meet another broadcasting pioneer. With additional material supplied by John Knipe and the engineering and technical assistance of Bob Schirego, the Golden Age of Radio is produced and edited by Brian Hartnett. This is Bill Schofield.
In music to all the big night spots of New York town, to hear the top songs of the week sung so clearly you can understand every word and sing
them. Al Kemp on the air for Griffin.
It's time to shine your shoes anyway.
Tony Home Permanent presents.
This is Nora Drake.
Roger, in the 25th century.
Ah, don't touch that dial. Listen to...